what a gorgeous tree.
Oh, thank you very much. I've never done this angle before because we've not had anything particularly. It's a fake one, believe it or not.
Oh my goodness!
No, it's basically AstroTurf, and yet is yours up? If you have one up, I don't know if it's.
Oh yeah, it's okay. Real.
Okay, all right. There's no need to.
It's real. It's we have to water it.
Wow, that is a flex.
Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest this week is a New York-based comedian, writer, animator, and artist who's appeared on Broad City, Billy on the Street, Difficult People, The Chris Gethard Show, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and Rachel Dratch's Late Night Snack, as well as in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and Reductress. She even also did the artwork for the Adult Swim show Joe Perra Talks With You. Her work has also been celebrated by Entertainment Weekly, Vulture Magazine, Paper, The Onion AV Club, and Forbes. Esquire Magazine even described her interview with Martin Shkreli as evidence that, quote, justice still exists in the world. She also created the Comedy Central hybrid animation miniseries Learn to Paint with Mary Houlihan, which I urge you all to check out on YouTube immediately. Over the course of the show, you'll hear about painting versus performing, what makes alt comedy alt, the difference in performing absurdist stand-up in Montana and Edinburgh, the canon of Jack Nicholson, and much, much more. So, please welcome my guest for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Houlihan. Mary, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me.
It's more than a pleasure. Now, I first became aware of you at the 2019 Edinburgh Festival with your phenomenal show, Me and Jack, about your very real relationship with three-time Academy Award winner Jack Nicholson, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we were originally going to speak at this year's Edinburgh Fringe. 2020 put paid to that. But just first off, how has 2020 been for you and three-time Academy Award winner Jack Nicholson? How have you been going strong?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, it's pretty good. This might surprise you. This actually happens to a lot of audience members of mine. They don't realize, because I'm such a good actor, that the show is actually fictional. And in real life, I'm not married to Jack Nicholson.
Shut the front door.
Yeah, it's just good writing and good acting can really, you know. So it's been pretty good. I mean, obviously, it's not good because of pandemic. But I feel like I've been coping well, and I have watched a decent amount of Jack Nicholson films while inside. By that, I think I mean I've seen 3 or 4.
Which ones? Which ones have been your mainstay to keep close to the great man?
I saw Witches of Eastwick, mm-hmm. and what's that other one? Oh, what's it called? You know the one.
Oh, sure.
I've seen a lot, actually. Okay, so I watched that, and I watched Terms of Endearment, mm-hmm. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, what's it called? The one where he has the gay neighbor. played by Greg Kinnear.
Of Mice and Men.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, that's it.
It was an unusual direction.
Yes, it's his gay neighbor. It's during the Dust Bowl. And I feel like I saw another rom-com where he's older. So I guess I've seen a decent amount of him.
Most of his back catalogue.
Yeah.
It's just one a day for the past 8 months. That's mm-hmm, fantastic. Mm-hmm. So you've basically continued living with him.
Yes.
That's nice. How do you approach writing something like that? Where does the idea of creating a show about a long-term multi-Academy Award-winning partner mm-hmm. come from?
Well, I do comedy bits
sure.
when I'm booked on shows. Typically, I'm asked to do a 10-minute thing, as you're probably asked to do on things. So sometimes I write jokes, sometimes well, you know, sometimes I write stand-up jokes, sometimes I write more of a bit with a PowerPoint or a character of some sort. And I really like doing kind of like feature-length shows, you know, plays, one-woman shows. So I've done a couple of those in New York, and for a while I was using a framing device that it was like a one-woman show about a girl trying to do a one-woman show, and it's going terribly. And so there were all sorts of meta elements and usually a backstage drama. Mm-hmm. My show, Live and Good, where it's the parody of a one-woman show. One time I did it, I had people play my parents in the audience, and they threatened to leave because they were so bored. And so then it was like I was doing bits, but then also with like a running gag of like, oh, it really has to be good so my parents don't leave. So, you know, basically I was trying to think of what will my framing device be for this next show, because I feel like I've already worn out that one-woman show parody. And the Jack Nicholson thing was sort of like a bit that me and my friends would do. You know how comedians do their bits.
I have heard.
Where, you know, a couple of my friends, they would do this thing with me where, like, if I showed up somewhere, they would say, like, oh, my God, it's so nice to see you. Where's Jack? Referring to Jack Nicholson. And then I would play along and do a whole thing where we would basically be alluding that he's, like, the worst boyfriend in the world and that my friends kind of want me to break up with him, and I'm kind of not emotionally there yet. So, you know, oh, I'm sorry he couldn't come to my best friend's birthday party, even though I told him it was really important to me. He wanted to watch TV tonight, and I said, Jack, it's not even live TV, it's so taped, and you've seen it a million times, but he kept insisting. So anyways, yeah, that's what I've been up to with Jack Nicholson. And I think also I had recently seen New York, New York. Do you know that movie?
I don't.
It's a Scorsese movie, a Scorsese flop, and it's Robert De Niro and Liza Minnelli, and it's basically a Star is Born type story, where it's like two stars, and the girl kind of starts to outshine him, and then it leads to marital problems. So I think I was really inspired by that, and then it occurred to me that, you know what, I think I've already written enough things about Jack Nicholson being a bad boyfriend that I could come up with a whole story about our rise and fall.
Sure, just borrow from real life, essentially. That's great. So few Scorsese movies seem to be used as comedic launching points.
I guess not. I'm trying to think of one.
There hasn't been like an Irishman based comedy special that I'm aware of. I might be wrong.
Wait, let me Google something.
Sure.
Let me Google something. Director. Who directed that? He did direct that. Oh, okay. Well, okay. Martin Scorsese directed Goodfellas. And in the Animaniacs original 90s version, they had a skit called Good Feathers, where it was three pigeons who were gangsters. So it's actually a long tradition in American comedy to, you know.
I can only apologize. I didn't do as much research into the Scorsese comedy line as I should have done.
Yeah, well, you know.
It just shows how ahead of the time Animaniacs was and continues to be.
Yes, absolutely.
You've mentioned how you've performed Me and Jack around the world.
Yes.
In of course, Edinburgh, of course, New York, LA, and then I also heard you performed in Montana.
Yes.
I know very little about Montana apart from Hannah. What is the comedy scene in Montana like?
It was really cool because I had never been to Montana, and I mean, you've seen a map. This country is really big. It's, if you haven't been somewhere, you are kind of like, I don't even know what it's like there, just going off of pop culture you've seen of it. So, you know, I've I've only lived in urban and suburban settings, so I just thought, I know there's mountains, and I think there's cows, and probably conservative. I bet it's kind of Canadian vibe because it borders Canada. So I think maybe it has a different flavor than like conservative Midwest America. Mm-hmm. I just really didn't know what to expect. And this guy asked me to come do a show there, and that, like, oh, don't worry, we'll, like, pay for everything, we'll pay for your flight. And I was like, I don't see how anyone there would want to come, but, I mean, okay. I guess I just have to get to the airport. That sounds fine, I'll do that. And lo and behold, Montana was actually cool.
Wonderful.
Just like, you know, all states like that in the U.S., like, if a state doesn't have, like, a major metropolitan area or, you know, is super conservative, these states always have what we call liberal oases.
Uh-huh.
So, in a college town is where, you know, the cool rock bands will come, or the restaurants will have vegan options or whatever. So, Missoula was, like, very, like, hip and, you know, lots of people dressed cool and lots of cool shops. So I was like, okay, I think they'll have the same cultural references as me.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. So, it was really nice. Yeah.
A little island of blue in a sea of red.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wonderful. And so how would you say it differed from New York or LA? Or was it sort of, could you have been in either of those?
I think the audience are probably the same kind of people, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Everywhere. I think there was a more stark difference doing it in another country, but everywhere I did it in America felt kind of the same.
Okay. So what was the biggest difference about Scotland then?
Oh my God, it was so interesting because, well, one time I did the show in New York and there was an English guy in the audience. And he, like, came up to me before the show and said, like, oh, I'm excited that you're coming to Edinburgh. I'm just visiting for the week. And so I said, oh, my God, I would love it if you told me after the show if there's anything in the show that doesn't make sense or if there's just, like, cultural language misunderstanding or pop culture thing that didn't make it there. Everyone's going to be like, what? So let me think. What did he tell me? I remember he told me, like, one pop group, not to mention them, because no one knows who they are. I forget what it is now. But then when I went over there and, like, told British people that, they were like, what are you talking about? Everyone knows them. What are you talking about? And some jokes would, you know, have a reaction that wouldn't get a reaction here and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And usually not from, like, a, you know, you guys say petrol and we say gas. Like, it seemed more like a cultural, what we think is funny or understanding of a thing. I guess, like, for example, there's this part in the show where I'm recounting how when I was a teen star, I performed at the MTV VMAs. Mm-hmm. And so then, I showed this video from the MTV VMAs. Like a real video where it's Christina Aguilera and she is like dressed insane and she like struts over to the podium and she says, what's up, New York? And that always gets a huge, huge laugh in the U.S., like an embarrassed, disgusted laugh when they hear that. They're like, oh, my God, because it's like such a 2000s phenomenon of like white pop stars trying to sound urban.
Uh-huh.
And I just felt like I always did it over there and day after day I'd be like waiting for it and like no one would laugh just because like, you know, they live in a different culture.
Sure. Did you find it funny how different the reaction was and where you're expecting a big explosion and you don't get it?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, all right. I think also jokes about Irish people work better there than here, so I enjoyed that.
That we've got centuries of practice. That's baked into the cultural part. Okay, that's really cool. And in addition to comedy, you were a phenomenal artist. And you went to art school in San Francisco, I believe. Mm-hmm. And seeing the paintings that you do, it seems to have a very sort of almost hyper-realistic normalcy to it, as opposed to sort of the absurdism of your comedy. Is that a conscious choice? Or is that... what is that?
No, not really. Okay. I don't know. I like to try to make things look like the thing, sure. You know?
Yeah, definitely. Well, you achieve that. What are your influences then in terms of art and then in terms of comedy?
Let me think. Well, what is his name? I think his name is Steve King. Let me Google this. Steve King artist. Well, I was really influenced by him, not during art school, but when I was like a comedian doing shitty jobs and trying to figure out how to make money. There's this artist who, I think he's done like a bunch of like album art for rock bands, and his main source of income is he makes paintings for like $25 each. Okay. Like maybe they're more now, but he just like mass produces like zillions of them from his house in Virginia and then mails them to people. And so in art school, you're kind of more thinking about like the fine art world. You want a whole thing that's going to take up a whole wall.
Sure.
And let's see, we'll price this at $15,000 and slowly I'll be able to charge even more. But that's just, it's so hard to break into that world. It's like really ridiculous. So that was an inspiration to me to start doing like commissions and do a sort of mail order model for my painting business. So I think that also influences my style, because like in art school, I spend weeks and weeks on a big thing. Mm-hmm. And now I just want to knock something out in an hour or a couple hours.
Sure.
So that's an art person. Let's see, comedy. Oh, you know, I like Steve Martin, the things from the 70s. I thought that was pretty influential.
Totally.
What else do I like?
It seems very similar to, and I've seen you compared to Maria Bamford quite a lot.
Oh, sure, yes. Blonde, cute voice.
Those are the abiding two things.
Yeah.
Sure. Was she a particular inspiration, or has that just been written about latterly?
Written about. I like her. I think if we looked more different, people probably wouldn't.
Sure.
Make the, yeah, or if we were different genders, people probably wouldn't compare us. What else? Oh, I really like, I said, The Simpsons and like Mel Brooks movies, mm-hmm. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Like, I really like, you know, super duper silly, super joke packed type of things. That's like what I want my plays to be like.
Well, from what I've seen, you definitely achieved that, and it is. It's a very sort of joyful, gleeful silliness that seems to be an abiding line through that. In interviews you've given before, you've spoken about how when at San Franciscan Art School, you weren't particularly part of the comedy scene, you didn't see a lot of comedy, but you started becoming more interested in improv and things like that.
Oh, yes. Okay, so what was interesting about this school is that you could only have a couple majors. You could be a painter, a sculptor, a printmaker, or like experimental film. And that was pretty much it. But it was sort of like a very contemporary way of seeing that. So for instance, I was a painting major, but in my painting critique, someone could bring in a sculpture. And so, you know, you could be a multi-hyphenate, but want to be viewed through one sort of lens, I guess. So I was a painting major, And while I was there, I started experimenting with making comic books and animations. And I think when I started doing that, I was like, this really feels like a good fit. This kind of makes more sense than painting. I really liked that they are temporal media.
Sure.
And they take time. It's not just a static thing that you go, what does this mean? It's a thing that you can watch and it makes you laugh or feel something. I thought that was kind of cooler or more real or something. And doesn't as easily fall into like the trap of stuffy art stuff. Like if you're watching a film with a plot, then you can't be like overly, what is this trying to say? Like, there's a clear message of what it's trying to say. Of course, there's subtext. I got really into like things that had plots that were funny, and I kind of didn't want to make work that was more like people in a gallery look at it and, you know, try to figure out what about the world is this trying to say. You know, I just wanted to make a thing that any idiot could enjoy. They don't need to be educated. So then I got more interested in comedy, and I was Googling all these TV writers, and it said that they got their start doing comedy in New York or LA, and then they get scooped up to write TV at some point. So I said, well, I guess I'll go do that. That makes more sense.
Absolutely. What is something that you learned from improv that you could share with us today? What is something that, apart from, most people I think are aware of the yes and phenomenon.
Oh, sure.
But besides that, it's a pretty opaque field. So what is something that has stuck with you particularly from classes or from sessions?
Oh my goodness. Trying to think. Well, I think I have, a unique perspective on improv. Like when I moved to New York, I did a year of classes at the UCB Theater.
Oh, sure.
And now it's very in vogue to think that it's a pyramid scheme. How did I spend 10 years there? It's horrible. They don't pay you. I was pretty quick to gather that. So that's why I was there for only a year. I was like, this is so ridiculous. Why don't you guys just put on a play at literally any of these hundreds of venues in New York City? There's no barrier to access. Just go do that instead of paying for classes. So
you were ahead of the curve.
I liked it, but I really hated the culture there and felt more free when I started doing like stand-up open mics and would meet people that had, well, I think all kinds of people, whether their humor is similar to mine or not, but you know, I ended up meeting more people that were into sort of alt or wanted to do more parody or play type things. And then a couple years later, another theater opened up in Brooklyn called the Annoyance Theater.
Okay.
And they were from Chicago, and they were so different from UCB, and a lot of people who had spent like thousands of dollars at UCB hated the Annoyance Theater and would be like really snobby about like they're not even doing real improv. And like, I went to a show and this guy was like laughing during the, like, you know, like they didn't like that they were loosey-goosey with the rules or would be meta with the rules or trust that the audience would like it if they broke the rules a little bit. So I never took classes there, but when they opened here, they enlisted a lot of people like me of like, well, we need to fill programming. Who does weird plays? So me and my friends did a bunch of stuff there, and I liked, well, I don't know, sort of my cumulative working knowledge of improv, pulling from that place, this place, other people that weren't trained at all, but improvised. I don't know.
Sure.
Just have fun out there. That's my key to it.
That's what we'll put on the poster.
Yeah.
You mentioned alt and alt comedy in that. It seems like there are two sides of it. Some sort of wear it as a badge. Others are quite sort of, not necessarily offended by the term, but are discussing it, for want of a better phrase. What do you think about it, and what specifically makes alt comedy alt?
Oh, sure. It's all kind of nonsense. I guess it does serve a purpose to differentiate. Like, if you were to go to, like, a comedy club in Midtown, New York, like, right by where the trains from the New Jersey and Long Island suburbs pop people out. There's comedy clubs there that cater to, you know, a more dumb, you guys see comedy on TV, this is what you want, and they just sell them a bunch of drinks and do, like, the dumbest, like, just basic material. Men are like this, women are like this, white guys are like this, black guys are like that.
Sure.
You know, stuff that I wouldn't like to see too much.
Mm-hmm.
So then alt, I guess, is pretty much anywhere that isn't like that. Anywhere that isn't a club. Maybe it's like a rock club. Maybe it's a bar with a back room. You don't have to get two drinks. Maybe maybe the tickets are $10. Maybe it's free, but you're encouraged to get drinks. Maybe it's pay what you will. And the audience, I guess, tends to be artsier folks who, like, they might even be like, oh, I heard of so-and-so on some esoteric podcast, and I can't wait to go see them at this big show.
Sure.
I often get people being offended by it. Like, sometimes I feel like it's used in a way that isn't helpful. Like, I know a lot of people feel, well, for instance, when I do stand-up, I do pretty, like, you know, like, normal old-school jokes, set-up punchline. And I find a lot of people like me who do just normal set-up punchline, but they're a girl, or they're gay, or queer, or anything that's not typical of a comedy club, or, you know, they dress different than a comedy club comedian.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, this is so weird, this is so alt. And then you're like, this is like your basic, this isn't like an experimental whatever. And so it's annoying when, like, you know, a booker for Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon or whatever says, like, well, you won't make sense to our audience because this is too alt. And then you're like, no, this isn't alt. I'm just a girl.
You're just not Marc Maron. There's a larger spectrum.
I mean, even that, I feel like they would say, whoa, this is out there.
Sure. Is buying a certain number of drinks a particularly strong thing in American comedy? Because we don't have that
at yet. Comedy clubs, yeah.
Is it?
There's, what's it called? A minimum. Like, that's really? Pretty standard at any okay. sort of place that's called, like, the Baltimore Funny Bone.
Okay.
Or I think the Comedy Cellar is like that. Caroline's is like that. Yeah, all those kinds of places caters more to, like, a tourist, like a money pit, like,
sure.
Oh, it costs $20 to get in, and then, surprise, you need to get two drinks. Also, you're heavily encouraged to order a meal item, and, you know, everything is, like, a soda is, like, $4 instead of $1.
And, wow.
And of course we're doing gratuity because it's the States.
Naturally. And tax is a separate thing that's kept hidden until the last moment.
Sure, yes. So at, like, a comedy club, I feel like they try to trick you into paying $50 to see
Yeah.
Stuff you could see on YouTube.
It's amazing the business model has lasted this long.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of the rise of alt comedy without the drink minimum.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, from one form of artwork to another, and I discovered your interview with Martin Shkreli, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Oh, sure.
For those who don't know or have gleefully forgotten about, he is the farmer bro, quote unquote, who hiked the price of an HIV life saving drug from about a tenner to $750, and you interviewed him shortly before incarceration. How did that come about? How did you approach that, and what do you remember about it?
Well, that was crazy. I worked at a company called Seriously.tv, which is its own thing. I could talk about that for days. So
Feel free.
Was like a comedy website, and it was funded by Hearst, the corporation Hearst, and
the newspaper people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Verizon. Hearst and Verizon in a joint venture. And I think there must have been some sort of, like, very oblique financial reason for them to do this.
Like a tax loophole.
Because, let's make content for people to enjoy. I think it was sort of like, we'll post these videos on Facebook, and then everyone that likes the videos then will have access to their data.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then we can, like, sell the data. Like, I think it was, like, that sort of thing.
Full
and, like,
Edward
the
Snowden.
Videos were just the... you know, the vehicle for that to work.
Wow.
They actually had two websites. Not a lot of people know this. They had two. One was Seriously.tv, and it was marketed towards blue states. And they had another site called Rated Red, where they made videos with, like, our counter selves. So, you know, it was like on-air personalities, and they filmed in Nashville, and they talked about, like, hunting. So anyway, so I think it was just a way to get a bunch of people to like these things on Facebook and then do something with that data.
Wow.
Anyway, so we were making comedy videos. We had to make, like, 5 videos a day. It just let's get as many views as possible and come up with as many ideas as you can. And I think Martin Shkreli had tweeted his phone number and was like, what's up? Like, if anybody wants to ask me anything, shoot the number. And so then one of my coworkers was like, LOL, let's call him. And so then we were, like, prank calling him and, like, giggling about it. And then, a producer that worked there was like, wait, we should ask him to do a video. We shouldn't just be prank calling him for fun. And so then I was like, oh, no, he's going to remember my voice. No, he didn't. And my boss at Seriously, he had worked on the Ollie G show. So he had all this advice for, like, ambush interviews. He said that we should reach out and be super flattering and say that we want to interview him about this and that. And then, you know, when he shows up, it'll be something different. So I sent him an email saying, like, hi, I work at... By this time, the company had been sold to Complex Media, which is, you know, more hip-hop and cool brand. And so I said, like, I work at Complex, and I know you're a guy who, like, grew up in Brooklyn, represent, and I know you're a big hip-hop fan. So us at Complex, we want to just, like, interview you about, like, your favorite rap groups. And it was super just, like, flattering towards him. And so he was, like, awesome. You know, like, thought it would be a thing where, like, you look cool on Vice type of thing. And so my boss said, so come up with some questions like that and just ask him boring questions for 45 minutes and then do all of your funny, mean things, and then we'll just use those. So I talked to him for, like, an hour, and he really liked me. And then I was like really nervous being in the room, like knowing like, okay, pretty soon I'm gonna have to, I hope I don't mess it up. And I hope he doesn't walk out immediately. And then we only have footage of like one funny thing. But he seemed, yeah, I was way more scared that he would like run out when we started fucking with him. But I think he just seemed like confused because he was like, well, they've been nice to me for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think they're making fun of me, but I guess I'll keep sitting here. So anyways, that's how that happened.
Wow.
Yeah. We hit him in the head with a boom pole twice.
Twice.
Because I wasn't sure if the first one looked good. And so then when we did it the second time, I was like, I can't believe he's not leaving. So it was really a socially strange time.
Yeah. Well, do you have inclination to do something like that again in the sort of... Because it seems like a sort of... In the Daily Show style vibe, in addition to Ali G... is that something you'd want to go back to, or are you quite happy leaving that as the sort of one foray into punk interviewing or punked interviewing?
I think if I were to do it again, I would want to be a very stylized character. Like, I really liked the Colbert Report. Did you see that?
I'm a huge fan.
Oh, sure, yeah. So I loved the way that he did that. Mm-hmm. Or I love the Ali G show. All those characters, I think, are great interacting with people. So, yeah, I think something, the way, like, a lot of Daily Show characters, where they're kind of mostly themselves, I don't know that I'd be super good at that, but I would have fun, you know, pretending to be someone talking to these people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we see something of that in the future. I suppose you can't really tell me if you have something planned for that. It would ruin the surprise. So we can
Okay.
We just have to assume there's it's going to be the second Rudy Giuliani moment.
Yeah.
It's essentially investigative journalism now.
Yeah.
It's the new Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein. Your podcast, Mary Houlihan's Little Podcast, has a phenomenal concept, which is if I'm right in saying every episode is a different genre entirely.
Yeah.
How do you approach something like that? Plan something like that out?
Well, I'm glad to hear that you like it, because I stopped doing it and I was like, I hope it's good. I think I maybe spread myself too thin by having to come up with a new thing all the time. And I think I do kind of feel that way. I feel like some of the episodes I'm really proud of, and some of them I'm like, you know what, I didn't even need to record that week. I could have skipped that. yeah, so I was approached by them, Forever Dog, and a lot of the podcasts that they had were like, we're two friends, and we talk about true crime. We're two friends and we talk about, you know, they had very like clear cut themes. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I don't know. You guys are going to say no. You guys are going to say get back to the drawing board. I kind of just want to do like everything. Could I just do everything? And I know that's like really hard to market as a podcast. You want like a quick, snappy, it's a show about this. Can I just do a show where every single show is completely different and it's really hard to promote? And they were like, sure. So yeah, what did I do? I had like a mini series that was kind of like Serial. It was like a true crime mystery to find out who had stolen my friend's American Girl doll.
Sure.
I had another one where me and my friend were, we were kind of being like... What do you call low-hanging fruit podcast hosts where we're just like, we want to talk about sex. We're going to totally talk about stuff that other people are grossed out by, and we're not prudes. We're so into sex. And then it's revealed that we're a virgin. we did another one that I thought was pretty good. with my friend Nick Nanny, and we were kind of just being like 20-year-old boys that are into streetwear and like everything that's cool right now.
And a full musical. A full musical.
Oh, yeah. We had musical improv. That was great. You know what? I forgot about that when you mentioned improv. So, as I said, a lot of my improv has been, independent and just like, hey, the two of us, let's do a show and we don't have to do it by this place's rules. So, for a while, I was hosting a musical improv show. It wasn't like an amazingly attended show or like, I'm going to turn this into the next hot thing. It was really just like, I just want like a fun night every week and also to practice singing. So I asked my friend if he wanted to do a musical improv show and it'll be like an open mic jam. Anyone can show up and we'll just make up songs. And I thought it was so fun. So we did a couple podcast episodes with me and him, and then we'd have guests.
Fantastic. Well, I hope there's plans to bring back the podcast, because there's, I don't know what genres are left untapped.
Sure.
But surely there's more being invented.
Of course.
There doesn't seem to be a lack of podcasts being generated at the moment. Being a prime example. But
his podcast I really liked was, it still exists forever, is Chelsea Peretti's podcast called Chelsea Peretti. And what I feel I was really inspired by her because she doesn't have like a schedule. She doesn't seem to, take it seriously or like want this to be one of her things. It really does just seem like, I think this would be fun and no, I'm not going to commit to doing it every week. And she'll literally, like, for a while she would do one every couple months, and now she does one like once a year super randomly, just seemingly whenever she's like, oh, this is a fun idea that would work as that. And so I think I would like my podcast to live forever in that way, that if a year from now I'm like, actually, I think I want to podcast, then I'll just release it, and then you'll look on the feed and there'll be a 3-year hiatus where nothing happened
and it's not mentioned at all.
Just
picked up exactly where it's going on. So how Beyoncé approaches Instagram, you are approaching podcasting.
Exactly.
It's a natural comparison. Perfect. Well, what would you say would be the best advice you've received, and what is the worst advice you've received about anything, whatever popped into mind when I said that?
Good advice, bad advice. I think good advice I've gotten is like, you don't have to do every single project, or like if someone wants to collaborate with you and you're a little bit like, they seem off, just say no. You don't have to be so precious. Like, I think I'm not a famous person at all. I've only had tiny successes. I'm quote unquote famous to like only the biggest nerds. Like, regular people don't know who I am.
Thank you.
And so, you're welcome. What was I saying? Oh, yes. So it feels like, I don't know, you just feel desperate career-wise and like you should say yes to everything. And, oh, but what if people stop asking you to do things? And then I say yes to everything. No, some things aren't funny and aren't your voice, or like the person is insane. So what, you might do it and then be like, aw, maybe more people would have heard of me if I did that. Well, you saved yourself probably a million headaches by saying no to something that gave you a bad gut feeling. So I think that's good advice, probably. What is bad advice? Let me think. Bad advice. I think bad advice is when people tell you that they distract you from what you're doing and tell you, like, you should do this because this will, I know this isn't really what you want to do, but this will, like, move your career ahead in some sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a big annoying thing I had with that was, do you know what the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival is?
I do, yes.
Yes, okay, so that's like a thing that makes comedians fucking insane and crazy and jealous of each other and like totally toxic. And it's a thing that like it seems like it's good to do because it's very like industry talk. Like if you have it on your resume, it might help you get like a really nice job.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when I was starting out, I would totally just do whatever I thought was funny, whatever I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like over time, and I had managers, but now I've fired them because I felt like they had such bad advice. But all these people saying, like, you're invited to do an audition. Oh, my God, you're invited. Okay, so instead of your act that you've been doing, we think what you should actually do is, and then they would like tell me to do like an SNL style, like do impressions of politicians. And I'd be like, that's really not what I do. I can do that in like an ironic way that's like making fun of that. And I feel like I just wasted so much time practicing my auditions for those things and never even got them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have rathered auditioning my own way. And then if I still didn't get them, maybe I'd feel like, oh, I should have taken their advice. But I would also feel like I went hard doing what I thought was funny.
Mm.
Did you see my hilarious video where I do SNL auditions?
I have, yes.
Well, I had it in part of my show.
Yes, with the the band member who enjoys the monologue.
Yeah. So after I posted that video, I got invited to showcase for SNL, which is where you do like a live show and then they pick like their two or three favorites to come for real audition at 30 Rock. So they asked me right after I made that video and I was like on the phone with my managers and I was like, so they like the video. I should just pretty much do that, right? Or will that offend them? They were like, no, they have, like, really good sense of humor about themselves. I think they like, you know, singing, like, their hip and, you know, making, laughing at themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Totally do exactly what you did in the video. And then, like, the night before, I got a call, like, oh, my God, so we just spoke to someone that worked at SNL, and we really think that instead you should just do topical impressions. Like, we really don't want to offend them. So then I was like, okay, and, you know, I didn't get asked to do the real audition at 30 Rock, so it does make me think. I kind of wish I had done my mean, sassy skit about them.
Sure.
Because maybe they would have liked it, and if they didn't, oh well.
Yeah.
Same sort result.
At least if you do the thing that you are most happy with, and
yeah.
it doesn't succeed, you go, well, that was what I wanted it to be. But it seems like your style of comedy and success in comedy has gone in such a sort of un-SNL-y fashion. It would have held you back. Would have held you back had you got it.
Thank you. It's funny, actress. That's what like everyone with amazing jobs and lots of money always says to me. Like, I feel like I have tons of friends who, like, like, Emmy Blotnick, she did Fringe last year. She's really funny.
Sure.
And she's worked on so many TV shows. I think she worked for Fallon for, like, several years.
Then, was she on, she worked for Colbert, or did I make that up?
Actually, yeah, she might have. I don't think she does now. Like, she's done a lot of, like, late night style shows and, like, more fun shows. And, yeah, I remember having a conversation with her once where she was like, oh, you're so lucky. I've spent, like, 10 years just, like, being a joke machine for these men in suits. And they never even used the jokes. They just used their own. And I'm just sitting at a desk, right? And I haven't written anything for myself, and I don't have time to do stand-up like I used to, and then I see you on social media, you're doing these plays, and it's totally straight from your brain to the stage, and there's no middleman, you're so lucky. And I was like, abstractly, I understand what you're saying. And yes, I am grateful, but it would be nice to have a one-bedroom apartment. Yeah.
Well, it swings and roundabouts, either way.
Yeah.
Well, I know of Noelle Wells, who was on SNL for, I think, a season, and then has since had this pop career and was on the Aziz Ansari Netflix show, which title escapes me right now, but you know the one.
Sure. Did you know I was cut out of an episode of that?
What? What? What were you doing, and why were you cut out?
Oh my god, it was so insane. This was like the worst week of my life.
Well, let's go in detail of this then.
The filming was the day before the 2016 election when Donald Trump won. Okay. And
sure.
And it was filming at Storm King. Have you heard of that?
No.
It's what like an that? Outdoor sculpture museum type thing in the New York metro area. It's a big thing, like people like renting a car and going to Storm King for the day. They got these big old sculptures. So okay. There's an episode in Master of None where he like takes a date to Storm King, and I totally nailed the audition and got the part for Wacky Tour Guide. And I was supposed to drive them around, him and like the Italian girlfriend, in a like a golf cart thing.
Sure.
And it'd be totally random while they're on this romantic date. And I'm saying the most random, crazy things. And, you know, it's totally, like, awkward. So we filmed some of it. And then they were sort of, like, talking amongst themselves. And I was like,
That's no idea.
And so then the director said, like, we're running out of daylight, and I really don't think we have time to do this scene. And, like, the actual important scenes where they're falling in love. So I want to say, you know, we'll film their stuff, and then we'll see if there's time. But I just have to be honest with you. I don't think there's going to be time. So, I don't know, if you want to go home. And I was like, we're at Storm King. How am I supposed to get home from here? Like, you know, I had to, you know, they were like, all right, you're ready to go home. And I was like, no, I have to sit here until 8 p.m. for, like, a production person to be free to drive me home. And they were like, oh, okay. Well, relax.
Wow, okay. Well, I'm glad I brought up those memories.
It's kind of funny.
It is. Oh, well, it's like reverse therapy. So so on the plus side, you weren't exactly cut out if you weren't filmed in the first place. So on a sort of silver lining,
I did get to be on set, and I did get to go up to Storm King.
There we go. Which is a day day out in and of itself.
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine you being the character, and I can picture it working well in the scene, and they only have themselves to blame, and that's probably why the show was cancelled.
Outside of anything, they totally blew it.
They did. Outside of anything Aziz did, I think that was the reason Netflix said.
Yes, I think so.
Two and done.
They got wind that I was cut.
Yeah, they thought we can't trust their judgment. So
yeah.
Well, fantastic. My final question is a broad one that I ask all the guests, which is, we'll make it into a two-parter. Why do we need stories, and why do we need surrealism?
Oh my goodness. Why do we need stories? Honestly, this is going to sound crazy. I think we need stories for the moralizing. And, you know, people say that art shouldn't be, moralizing, and you know, it should be whatever you want. We don't want all work to be moral. We want to have things with anti-heroes. We want Taxi Driver. This is not a story with a moral. Okay, that's true. But it is nice to have stories where someone does the right thing, and because life is often so unfair and so many horrible things happen, mm-hmm. and lots of good things happen in life as well. So it's, I think it actually is important to see in media, I don't know, like, that's why, like, the Bible is good. If you ignore everything bad that people do with the Bible,
sure.
like, it's nice to see someone who is, like, forgiving of everyone and helpful and nice and generous. That's why we need stories. And surrealism. Why do we need surrealism? Because everything's, like, made up. Everything's real, but it's made up, and you kind of need to be reminded. Like, don't take things so seriously.
Well, the miniseries Learn to Paint with Mary Houlihan and a special Mary Houlihan Live and Good are both streaming now on YouTube. Mary, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.